And in introducing him that day, I said, the good Lord must look down on us with such a benign look, because we not only are blessed with a president like Walter Reuther, we are blessed with people who lead our divisions, like the important General Motors Department, like Leonard Woodcock. And Leonard gave us an inspiring speech that night. And the 10 General Motors locals in Region 1E were so proud to be a part of the fight that was going on then. The first thing that our new president did the day following his election as president was to go to Atlanta to carry out a commitment that Walter Reuther had made to march with the Southern Christian Leadership Council protesting the murders at Johnson State and Kent State, Ohio colleges, which ought to indicate to anybody that the direction this union has been going in is not changing. Many people have called President Woodcock an extremely brilliant and competent man. That he is. But let me tell you, he is something else. He's a very warm and a very human individual. And I'm proud he's president of our union, Leonard Woodcock.
Thank you very much, Bard Young, brothers and sisters of Region 1E. Reference has been made this evening to Emil Mazie. And I would like to say to this group, as I've said now to several groups, if there ever there was a man who had a right to say to our executive board, I am entitled to consideration as president of this union, it was Emil Mazie. He has long been a leader at the top level in our union. He was one of the earliest fighters to make our union. Back in 1938, when Homer Martin had sold out to the Ford Motor Company and practically destroyed our union and led a group into the AFL, the first victory on the road back was in the early spring of 1939, when a strike was won against the Briggs Manufacturing Company, and the leader of that strike was the president of Local 212, Emil Mazie. And it was that victory that laid the basis for a strike later in that spring, the tool and die strike in General Motors, which won back recognition for our union in General Motors, led in the following spring of 1940 to NLRB elections, which extended the union in General Motors to 40 plants. And then, of course, 1 year later, in the spring of 1941, the historic strike against Ford, with which Emil was completely associated, was the first Ford director, and in the winning of the union shop. And our union from that time never turned back. But our board met on the afternoon of Friday, May the 15th, following the funeral. It was a very brief session. All of us were drained emotionally by that long, sad week. And Emil said to us, I have no personal ambition. I think it is my duty as the acting president to try and take this union through these next few days and keep it together. And I will only consider being a candidate if there are those who, because of personal ambition, may wish to tear this union apart. And as Douglas said, it was his skilled and masterful work in those days that made the transition out of our constitutional crisis so relatively easy. And to Doug Fraser, I say, this is a wonderful organization when two men can contest for a post which is as powerful as the post of presidency of the UAW and start that contest as close personal friends and finish the contest as close personal friends. That's a tribute to our union, but obviously it's a great tribute to Doug Fraser as a man. And to the members of our board, who sort of stood aside and let AML work the process out, and to the staff of this union, which across the United States and in much of Canada didn't involve itself in politicking or trying to be kingmakers or whatever, they too stood quietly by to hope the process would be worked out, and to the local union leadership, who did exactly the same thing. And Walter Reuther, of course, was a labor leader without compare, and he was a man, in my experience, without parallel. AML has said that his greatest contribution was unifying this union and keeping it unified. And another expression of that was that he was a dominant man. His personality and his brilliance obviously dominated our affairs. But unlike other dominant men in labor who have preceded him, he stood not in the way of any man in his development. He encouraged it. And I think a great tribute to him was that when he left, it was possible to take the organization and keep it on the march to realize his ideals. I think we can say after this month that our slogan of teamwork in the leadership and solidarity in the ranks is not an empty political slogan. It's a living reality. Now, if I may say, Doug said to you that under Leonard Woodcock, the style of the presidency will change, the philosophy won't change, but the style will change. And so when I had my first press conference on May the 22nd, a reporter said, Mr. Woodcock, Mr. Fraser said yesterday that under your leadership, the style of the presidency of the UAW would change. Would you care to comment? Well, I said, obviously, I'm not Walter Reuther. I said, I can say I don't smoke, but I have to stop there. And the magic that AML had worked in the week of decision followed us to Black Lake when we had our first board meeting. Because at the point that I had become president, we had a vacancy among the international vice presidents. And Article 10, Section 18 of our Constitution says, when there is a vacancy among the vice presidents, then we must choose from among the 17 United States directors, because we have already made the Canadian director a vice president, for the replacement. It's impossible to go outside the ranks of the board. We had a meeting on Monday afternoon of the officers, and I indicated that I would like to talk separately to each of the 17 men who are our United States regional directors, because I was very much concerned, not only for the sake of the union, as we all were, but as a person, as to who would become director of the General Motors Department. I've been very proud of my association with the General Motors workers and leadership. I've got a lot of investment in my life in it. And that obviously was tied up with the question of the vice president. When I met with each of these 17 men, I did not say to any one of them, this is what I want, this is what I demand you do, or this is what I urge you do, except I did say this. I was personally unwilling, since we already have a national leadership team of 9, to expand that to solve our problem, because when you've got 9 on top of 17, you move that 9 much more. You get an unwieldy relationship as against those who have the frontline responsibility in relationship to the local unions and leaders. And I was very happy when, after I'd met all of Monday evening, all of Tuesday morning, to be able to come back just before noon on Tuesday to the officers and say, there's an essential consensus to the proposition that if I nominate Irving Bluestone as the General Motors director, that then the board will not fill the vice presidency. And we then went into a general session of the board and talked it out for 2 or 3 hours. And it seemed so obvious that Irv Bluestone should be the GM director that everybody finally agreed. Because Irv used to be in the GM department, and although he's been gone from there for 15 years, he's remembered with affection and respect and trust, and that's the biggest item, by leaders still in GM who knew him. He left the General Motors department when I first became a vice president and worked with me primarily in aerospace. And in January of 1961, he went and became the assistant to Walter Reuther. And in that capacity, worked with Walter in every major set of negotiations in which Walter was involved, in General Motors, of course, and Ford and Chrysler and other major companies. And in those 10 years, he was the most intimately associated with Walter of any of us. And I think quite a bit of Walter rubbed off on him.
And so I recommended to the board, I nominated Irving as co-director of GM, myself continuing as director through the negotiations only, and after that to make him the full director. And let me say, the only reason I did this, and those of you who come from GM plants know General Motors has a peculiar habit. They got more computers probably than any company in the world. But every time the UAW does something, they, like the ancient Romans, examine the entrails of a chicken to try and figure out what in hell we're up to. And I figured if I just stepped out as director at this point, they'd figure, well, something's wrong. It would take them 72 hours to try and figure it out. My experience has been when they go through this agonizing process, they always come out wrong. So I thought, well, we'll ease their pain and we'll stay together, Irving and I and GM as a team. But the wonderful thing was that here are these 17 men, they had the votes. Even if the 9 of us in national leadership were to say no, those 17 men had the votes, they could have said any one of them was the vice president. But they said no, we agree, for the good of the union, Irving Bluestone should be nominated to this post. And they said, if we had the constitutional power, we would this day elect Irving Bluestone as a vice president, but because we do not have that constitutional power, we will hold the post open. And something tells me Irving may be a candidate in 1972. I'll be proud to work with Irv Bluestone in General Motors, and I'll be proud to work with Doug Fraser in Chrysler, and Ken Bannon in Ford. And having made the initial move on Irv in GM, it became so obvious that the aerospace department that I've worked with for 15 years, that Ken Bannon should take those responsibilities, in addition, of course, to the Ford department. And I'm sure that the aerospace local unions will give him the great support they've given me for these years. And then it became possible, and this is important in our union, Nelson Jack Edwards has not had a full collective bargaining responsibility. And so it has become possible to take all the non-Ford assignments that Ken Bannon had, important ones, Bendix, BorgWarner, and other companies, and add those to the responsibilities Jack previously had, so that at the top level now we have a balanced team with regard to collective bargaining responsibilities. And I'll be proud to work with Pat Greathouse in Ag Imp, and about that I want to say a couple of things in just a few minutes. Now, there was some concern expressed that I'm GM-oriented. Of course I was GM-oriented, because that was my job. But I suppose, luckily, I did go to every General Motors sub-council in the meetings that we had before the convention, and said to each of those sub-councils, on the question of when we pick a target, that the Ford Motor Company is not exempt because it had a strike of 7 weeks 3 years ago.
Because if it stood by itself as an independent company, it would have to face that possibility. And the Chrysler Corporation is not exempt because it's in temporary trouble. Because again, if it was an independent company standing by itself, it would have to face that possibility. And the General Motors Corporation is not exempt just because it's big. Now, the successful strategy and tactics of Walter's incumbency were developed on a collective basis, but more importantly, they were developed out of basic realities. If this union ever were foolish enough to strike the whole industry, we wouldn't have any competitive factor working. This nation went for 4 years in World War II without building passenger cars and stayed on wheels. If we struck the whole industry at one time, that strike would grind on and grind on and grind on until it inflicted massive economic damage on the nation. And at that point, the government would step in and we'd get a government-dictated settlement. And that settlement would be worse than we get by following the strategy and tactics that we have always followed. How many times has Walter told us, the way to their hearts is by squeezing them in their pocketbooks. And that's what our tactics are. And that will continue to be done. And someday, late in August, or maybe even early in September, since the contracts run to September 14, Doug Fraser and his committee in Highland Park from Chrysler, Herb Bluestone and his committee on the fifth floor of the GM building, Ken Bannon and his committee out of the glass house in Dearborn, they'll get an offer. Now you understand these companies don't talk to each other, but it's by some strange magic that offer will be the same in every one of those places. It'll not only be the same, but it'll be far short of our equity, and it'll be far short of what we're going to get. And at that point, we together will make the necessary decisions. Amel has said, and he's absolutely right, we are going to carry out the mandate of our convention under the direction of Walter Reuther. Let's take this question of 30 and out with $500 minimum, which is one of our cardinal points. They're going to say, oh, that's very expensive. It costs a great deal of money. Well, you know, we started bargaining pensions with the big three, $49.50. The first Ford pension was cost 8¾ cents by the reckoning. GM was a little less, 7½ cents a few months later. But every time we added a piece to those pensions, and we've improved them greatly, in each of those bargaining packages, there was a certain number of pennies that went to pensions. Now, if you add all those pennies together, they're a pretty sizable sum. But last year, General Motors paid for its pension program only 22 cents per hour. Now, how does that happen? Well, they put the money into a trust fund, and they're paying off all the past service over a 30-year period. But then the trustee invests much of that money in common stocks. And as long as the market was going up and up and up and up, as it did for 8 years, every once in a while they'd sell off some of those stocks. And then the money gain, the profit they made, went to reduce their pension costs. So some of those pennies we bargained for have gone. And we have a right to say to these companies this year, hey, what about those past pennies that have disappeared back into your pockets? Plus, they're going to tell us they're terribly worried about inflation, and it's our job to stop inflation. Well, with regard to pensions, when you bargain so many pennies for pensions, and those pennies are put into a trust fund, and that fund is paying out less than that proportionately for benefits, that's not inflationary. It's counter-inflationary. So the more we do in pensions, the more we'll be helping fight inflation. It's going to be a pretty good thing, and we're going to do it. Now, I've been saying to the groups, and I'm sure I spoke for them, and I said this to the Retirees Council, Detroit area meeting last Monday, we will not conclude an agreement with any company without getting equivalent equity for our retirees. Now I'm told, our lawyers tell me today I can't say that anymore, because there was a court decision some time ago involving Pittsburgh Plate Glass, which said companies were compelled to bargain over the question of retirees' pensions and related matters. Unfortunately, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in Cincinnati today reversed that decision. And they said it is true that companies do this, but they do it out of a warm, sympathetic regard for their retired employees. Well, because the lawyers have told me, I'm going to say it differently. They don't have, that is General Motors and Chrysler and Ford, if they don't have a warm, sympathetic regard for the retirees this trip, they're going to find as hard as hell to get along with and everything else. Now on the question of a substantial wage increase, and the 26 cents that's piled up on the cost of living that we would have gotten under the old formula that we haven't gotten, and it's piled up to 26 cents, and under the overage letter, it's payable on the 15th of September. Well, the rubber workers had a strike they just settled, and their first year wage increase was 26 cents. I think they're trying to tell us something. They're trying to tell us that that's our first year wage increase. But we're telling them, uh-uh. That 26 cents, that belongs to 67, like our convention said. We still want a first year wage increase. And this notion that the automobile workers have got it made, I don't think it's true. When you take the loss of overtime and you get back to straight time and you take the average production worker, if his wife isn't working, if he's got small kids and the wife is staying home to look after those kids, he's having one dickens of a time getting by. I was in Indianapolis last Sunday along with Doug and along with Emil, and after the press conference I was walking down the aisle, and one of the housemen stopped me. He said, "Brother Woodcock, can I shake your hand?" And I was a little bit surprised, you know, because I thought I was president of the UAW, not the hotel and restaurant workers. And so I shook his hand, and as I'm shaking his hand, he said, I work at Ford's. So a guy standing alongside said, "Oh, you're moonlighting, eh?" And he looked kind of pitiful. I guess he thought I was going to be angry. And he said, "I can't make ends meet. I got several small kids at home. I can't make ends meet on what I make at Ford." And when you take less than $8,000, which is all an assembly line worker makes, if he works full-time, straight-time, you can't make out. And that's why we have to get a substantial wage increase. And that's why we have to restore our cost of living to where it was. Now they're going to give us a rough time. Weeks ago, Business Week said, the U.S. can't afford what labor wants, and this is a relatively liberal business magazine. In that same issue, their editorial said, labor is asking too much. I don't know how many of you saw back on the financial pages of the Free Press this morning that story about Gulf and Western Metals Forming Company. Gulf and Western bought Metals Forming Company in 1966. It's a conglomerate. They don't care about people. They're just accounting cost figures. And so they notified yesterday, 2 days ago, the committee, the unit of Local 189, this plant is closed. They're going to move the work to more efficient producers in this area. And they don't have transfer rights. And there isn't enough money in the pension plan to pay off the pensions. They've got two individuals, one a man, one a woman, who have worked for that company for 37 years. They were both born in 1918, which means they're 52 years old. And under our pension plans, you know, we have to work so that the past service is paid out over 30 years into the future, and they're not fully funded until those 30 years have all gone by. And this plan isn't fully funded any more than any of our plans are fully funded at any given day. And so when there isn't enough money and the plan comes to an end, they start down by order of age priority. And there won't be enough money to pay these two who have worked 37 years for this company a pension. Now, we have been begging the Congress of the United States for at least 6 years not to put taxpayers' money behind this, but to set up a tax system with a small percentage of payroll, just like the insurance of bank deposits, like the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, to back up this type of situation when these small employers usually go out of business. And we can't even get the bills out of committee, let alone through the Congress. And yet 2 days ago, when the Penn Central Company, a corporation worth $7 billion, I guess it must be mismanagement because they changed the management on the same date, they came to the United States government and within 24 hours were told the United States government would back up their bonds with $200 million of taxpayers' money. Now, we don't want to see the Penn Central Company go into bankruptcy, but what about a man and a woman who worked for a company for 37 years, and they then take their work and put it into a more efficient establishment, and they're left without any pension protection? There's something wrong with our national priorities. There's something wrong about these gentlemen who write these editorials and are concerned about the industrial worker getting too much. And with regard to inflation, we've got to keep pounding into the heads of our people what a great president of the General Motors Corporation said in 1949, Mr. C.E. Wilson, that it is not wages, he said, not wages that push up prices, but prices that pull up wages. And what was true then is true now. The Nixon administration has deliberately cut back the economy. They have deliberately boosted interest rates to the highest levels in 100 years. Now, how you reduce the cost of living by increasing interest rates is something I don't understand. But there's many things Mr. Nixon is doing I don't understand. The unemployment rate is now officially at 5%, and that doesn't count all the people who are unemployed. If a man is unemployed and the government puts him on a training program and pays him $1.45 an hour, he's no longer unemployed, they say. Or if you're in an area where jobs are impossible to find and you quit looking for them, you're written off as a statistic, you're no longer unemployed. I guess you've ascended into heaven to come back when the economy picks up. And we're in the fifth consecutive increase of unemployment. Now, the fact is that the burden of this so-called war on inflation is almost entirely on the working people. Now they're trying to tell us that we need price and wage controls. And unfortunately, some of our best friends in the House of Representatives are pushing this proposition. Not mandatory controls, voluntary controls. You know, they set a percentage. And then we're supposed to comply with that percentage. Well, if they stick to this, they're practically going to guarantee a strike in one of the companies this fall. Because what will happen? Let's say they pick 6%. Let's just pick any figure out of the air. And they say that's all you can do. Why, the General Motors Corporation, they will give us an offer, and Chrysler and Ford will follow suit. It'll be right on the button with whatever the guideline says. And then they'll wrap themselves in the flag, and they'll say, we're not defending General Motors' profits, we're defending the national interest. And if they don't budge, and they may not, then a strike will be guaranteed. Now, of course, we're concerned because working people are the chief victims of inflation. And I know figures are boring, but let me give you just a few figures that Nat Weinberg developed for us, because it tells a very vital story. Now, these figures are in terms of constant 1957-1959 dollars. So that although it's different periods, they're the same value dollars. And these are the earnings of working people after deductions for Social Security taxes, income taxes, adjusted for price and tax changes. Now, if taking all the production and non-supervisory workers on private, non-agricultural payrolls, 47 million of them, then in these constant 1957-1959 dollars, in the fourth quarter of 1965, their average weekly earnings were $79.12. In the first quarter of 1970, their average earnings had gone down to $77.53, or a reduction of 2%. Now, if you take manufacturing workers, that is auto and ag imp and steel and whatever, out of that group, in the same constant dollars in the fourth quarter of 1965, their average earnings were $89.24. In the first quarter of 1970, had gone down to $86.15, a reduction of 3.5%. Well, you may say, okay, that's unfortunate. That's inflation. Everybody's in the same boat. Oh, no. Oh, no. If you take the economic population as a whole, including the 47 million that are down by 2%, the total economic population is up by 10.2%. And that includes the 47 million. If you take that 47 million out of that total group, then the rest of the economic population are up by 14 and 15%. And now they want to put the burden of added sacrifice on those who have been the greatest victims of inflation. The building trades workers, you know, won't be affected because they don't bargain in big blocks. They bargain in this local market, that local market, the other local market. And the other day, Mr. Nixon invited the leaders of the New York building trades to his office. They didn't bother to talk about the dirty world of economics. They were there because Mr. Nixon wanted to pat them on the back because they'd kicked the hell out of a few kids in Wall Street in New York. So the building trades, who have gone up 22%, 25%, 27%, 32%, 35%, they won't be affected. The only ones that will be under the gun will be the industrial workers, and the ones who will be really under the gun will be the automobile workers and the agricultural implement workers. Well, we're not going to buy it. We're not going to buy it. We're going to fight it with all we've got because it's wrong. It's immoral. You cannot take the group that has been the worst off by virtue of this process and then say that group and that group alone will carry the burden of sacrifice. If the nation is going to consider such a policy, it should be an incomes policy. It should apply to all economic groups. It should apply to lawyers and doctors and professionals and merchants and bankers and everybody, not just industrial workers. And we're not going to buy it. Let me say just a couple of words about the agricultural implement industry. When I was first elected a vice president in April 1955, I was made director of the Agricultural Implement Department. I was director until the end of the year. We went through a round of collective bargaining. And our program and our slogan then was to catch up to auto. In skilled trades, they were behind by 10 cents an hour. They didn't have a union shop. And at the end of the bargaining, we had caught up to auto. But today, the agricultural implement workers are ahead of the automobile workers. In those 15 years, they sort of snuck beyond us. Now, this is a lower profit industry than auto, and it's a competitor. Harvester, Caterpillar, Alice Chalmers, John Deere, they make trucks, they make earth-moving equipment, and they are competitors to General Motors, to Ford, and to Chrysler. And here's what the agricultural implement workers under contract with UAW have that we don't have in auto. In vacation, they have an extra year of vacation, a week of vacation at 20 years of service. And then they have a Christmas shutdown. The plants all go down the day before Christmas, and they don't start operating again until the day after New Year's, and they get paid for all what would have been work days in between. We don't get that, do we? Vacation bonus. They get a vacation bonus of $100. The individual gets $75 when he takes his regular vacation, and he gets $25 when he takes his Christmas shutdown vacation. They have voluntary overtime. They manage to build the trucks by not having to say to a guy, "Oh, you got a date with your wife? Oh, too bad. You're staying here for a couple more hours." They don't do that in the agricultural implement industry. And then in Caterpillar, they have a rather interesting little feature. When a worker gets laid off there, if he's got 1 year of service up to five, he gets 3 weeks of full pay before he goes on SUB. If he's got 5 years of service but less than 10, he gets 5 weeks with full pay before he goes on SUB. If he's got 10 years of service, he gets 7 weeks at full pay before he goes on SUB. Now I repeat, these are the competitors of the General Motors Corporation and the Chrysler Corporation and the Ford Motor Company. So if a slogan in Ag Imp in 1955 of catch up to auto was okay, maybe we should have a slogan, two slogans, in two parts. Have auto catch up to Ag Imp, and then have them both catch up to where they should be, together. Let me say very quickly, the problem of inflation in this country is the fact that we're pouring money down a rat hole. It's not only the question of the war in Indochina, and we all agree with what Emil Mazie says. We have no business there. You know, some people say it's an imperialist war. I wish there was that much sense to it. But in 1966, the last year for which we had published figures, American capital invested in Eastern Asia, including Japan, not just Southeast Asia, all of Eastern Asia, had a money return of $248 million. Now, if any individual spent $30 billion a year to protect $248 million of income, you'd say he had rocks in his head. And he would have. And we are in a place where we're interfering with people's destinies and unfortunately wasting the lives of American men. But even if you set aside the question of the war, the $74 billion that's in our this year's federal treasury for military spending can be sharply cut back because it is the most grossly inefficient spending anywhere in the country. If the automobile industry spent money in the same inefficient way that the defense industry does, we'd all be out of work because the industry would be bankrupt. It was General Eisenhower who warned us against the military-industrial complex, and it's a corrupting thing the way it works. Back in 1959, a congressional committee revealed that the 100 top defense contractors had on their payroll 721 retired military officers who had held the rank of Army Colonel or Naval Captain or above. Now, many of these had been contracting officers. They'd sat on this side of the table, representing the government and the people, bargaining with Lockheed and all the rest of them for the price of a contract. Then 3 years later, they're working for these companies they've been bargaining with. It's the greatest conflict of interest there can possibly be. And by 1969, that number of 721 had grown to 2,072. Is it any wonder then that you have these gross cost overruns? The C-5A had an estimated cost to begin of $3.4 billion. It's up to $5.2 billion and still going up. Now the plane doesn't go up because it has a little habit of its wings falling off, but the costs are going up. They also had a man called Mr. Fitzgerald. Mr. Fitzgerald was a high-ranking official in the Pentagon whose job it was to look after costs. So one day, he felt very good, I imagine, he uncovered a cost overrun of $2 billion. Yeah, even in the Pentagon, $2 billion is money. You'd think he'd get a promotion. Couldn't get a medal because he was a civilian. They transferred him to Thailand. They transferred him to Thailand. Now they say you can't possibly know what the costs on these complex systems are because they're new and you just can't know. But when Mr. Fitzgerald was sent to Thailand, he was put to checking the costs on a rec center. And he found that the bowling alleys had cost overruns too. It's sort of a habit. So when he came up with the cost overruns on the bowling alleys, they fired him. He's now not in Thailand anymore. He's back in the United States. This is where we can tackle the problem of inflation by bringing the federal budget essentially into balance. And again, I say, if that doesn't do it, then we should get all the people to share the burden of sacrifice through the method of taxation. And let me say, on the question of going to Atlanta, I was proud to walk arm in arm, representing our union with Ralph Abernathy and Mrs. Coretta King in that march against repression. And I was proud to be a participant in the program at the end of the march at Morehouse College. And I said to that audience, and through them, I said to those of the 1,600,000 members of our union who are not yet believers, that they have got to understand that this union cannot be a truly effective defender of the rights of its members except as it can function in a fully free and democratic America. We have these beliefs not because Walter Reuther had them, and of course he had, but Walter Reuther didn't impose these beliefs on us. They come out of our organization. We have always had to have unity of black and white workers, or we wouldn't have a union. And if we were to stand aside and let those forces who want to take black Americans and shove them aside and oppress them and push them away, what do you think would happen the day they decided to break us? They'd have a naturally made army of strikebreakers, and that's part of this proposition. So we are for these things because they're morally right, but we're also for these things because it makes a matter of decent self-interest. You can't have a union without having a unity of all workers, black workers, white workers, brown workers, all workers. And that's why we stand for these positions. As Paul Morris announced at noon on Friday, I will have the privilege of presenting on behalf of our union to Cesar Chavez and the farm workers a truck, and on that truck will be put the Freedom Bell, the bell for Delano, coming from a bombed-out church in London, which is bound in chains, and they'll loosen those chains when they've won their strike and they're making strides. And as Paul said, that we'll advocate two things now: the continued boycott of non-union grown and harvested grapes, but also the sale, promoting the sale of union harvested and grown grapes. I'd like to say to you about this truck. I was over at Local 600 before I joined Bard, and I had to confess to them this is going to be a Chevrolet truck. General Motors did knock a bit off the price. They were trying so hard to be nice. They took the truck out to the Milford Proving Grounds because they wanted to give it to us in tip-top condition. The only trouble is when they got it out there, they wrecked it. And so they hurriedly had to find us another truck, and I hope that's in tip-top condition because it's got to travel across the country. And as Amel has said with regard to the 1970 elections, I suppose we always say about an election, it's critical and it's important, and in a democracy they always are. But I think this is the most critical and important we've had in many, many a day. If there's any magic in the American system, it is that the man who sits in the White House, no matter who he is, no matter of what party, he tends to try to pull the American people together. And this is what Mr. Nixon promised us on the 20th of January, 1969. But unfortunately, his administration today is setting region against region, class against class, race against race, when our nation is being torn apart. And we can no longer rely upon the Supreme Court as the defender of individual and collective liberty. And it well may be in the years of 1971 and 72, there may be only one body in the United States as a defender of liberty, and that can be the Senate of the United States. And it's so terribly important to return Phil Hart to that Senate. Phil Hart is a low-key guy, but he's a man of the greatest courage. When it's a basic problem, you never need to worry about him. Never need to worry about him. We've already lost one senator, Ralph Yarber of Texas, a great man, a great liberal, chairman of the Senate Labor and Education Committee, got knocked off in the Texas primary a few Saturdays ago. I spent an hour with Ralph Yarber, and he said his people had carefully checked, and they estimate that Benson, the man who defeated him, a right-wing oil man, that those forces spent $6.5 million in that campaign. They had billboards in Texas, and a reputable billboard company estimated that those boards cost at least $500,000 and maybe as much as $1 million, depending upon how much they got as a discount against the regular price. And they got Ralph Yarber, so we're one down. But we've got other places where we can make recovery. And this goes to the cap drive that you've got going here. I hope Juanita does top the other regions, and then I hope the other regions hear about it and decide to beat Juanita. Because we need that money desperately. We can only spend that kind of free money in a federal election. And we've got to have that money. And I'd like to say to Bard Young, you're a great guy, Bard. Every once in a while you say something to me reprovingly and sternly, and when you do, you're usually right. And I take it to heart, and I treasure your friendship. We've been talking tonight about this union being greater than it was in answer to the tragedy. And there is a process in chemistry which is called synergism. It's an almost magical process. When all of the ingredients go through a process and the total that comes out is greater than the sum of what went in. And this, I think, is what's happening to our union. All of us are responding. All of us are responding with something, I suppose, that was always there, but we never really called on it, and now we're calling on it. And we have to. We face grave difficulties. Without Walter, the road is steeper. But we're going to stand together. And when this year is done, if there is a place in the great beyond where a man can look back at those with whom he was associated, we are going to so conduct ourselves in collective bargaining and in the elections of 1970 that when the year is concluded, Walter will look down and say, "Well done."
Repeat the phrases that Doug Fraser used on behalf of Region 1E. Our union is in good hands. Having come back from the executive board at meeting at Black Lake, I left with only one slight frustration, and that is that I wanted to vote for the new co-director of the General Motors Department for vice president. And in examining the Constitution, where we hadn't looked at it for about 20 years, we found out we couldn't do it. But if you'll recall, about 2 years ago, this young fellow came to our regional conference, and he made a speech on behalf of Walter Reuther that night, and he spoke for himself, however. And he brought the conference to its feet.
Oh, yes.
Because he's the kind of a guy that you will be proud of and will know that the fate of the General Motors negotiations are also in good hands. I give you now the co-director of the General Motors Department, Irv Bluestone.
Leonard Amel Doug, my good friend, Regional Director Bart Young, brothers and sisters of Region 1E. This has been a long evening for you, and I promise I will be brief, very brief. You know, it touches one's heart when the new president of our organization makes the kind and generous remarks that Leonard did about my past experience and the support which the executive board gave me in giving me this new post. And I'm no less touched and overwhelmed by the kindness of Regional Director Bard Young in the manner in which he introduced me. The tasks ahead in the General Motors Department as co-director are formidable, and I recognize that. As a matter of fact, they're so formidable that they reminded me of a little story that I used to tell some years ago. It had to do with a hotel telephone operator, one of these fancy hotels, and she was a night shift telephone operator. And one night, about midnight, there was a light up, and she answered, and a voice came on saying, "Miss, can you tell me what time the bar opens up in the hotel?" And she said, "Yes, sir, it opens at 10 in the morning." He said, "Thank you," and hung up. About an hour later, the same voice, "Miss, can you tell me what time the bar opens up in the morning?" And she said, "Yes, sir, I think I told you earlier, at 10 o'clock in the morning." And he said, "Thank you," and hung up. And each hour, almost on the hour, came this same voice. And finally, about 8 o'clock in the morning, "Miss, can you tell me what time the bar opens up?" And she said, "Yes, sir, I've told you, 10 a.m. and hung up. A few minutes later, the assistant manager came in on his rounds that morning, and he asked her how things went. She said, "Oh, it was kind of quiet, except for one pest who kept calling me almost every hour, wanting to know what time the bar opens up. And I'd tell him, and he'd keep calling back." And as she was describing this, the board lit up again. On came the same voice, "Mish, can you tell me what time the bar opens up?" And she said, "Here he is again." The assistant manager took the phone. He said, "Look, are you the fellow who's been bothering our telephone operator all night asking what time the bar opens up?" He said, "Yes, sir." He says, "Well, she told you it opens at 10 o'clock in the morning, but we're not letting you in." And the voice came back, "I don't want to get in. I want to get out." And I just hope and pray that as the months go by and we get deeper into GM negotiations, I won't feel as if I want to get out, but rather stay in with Leonard and my other buddies. 4 weeks ago tomorrow, I had the agonizing experience of standing on the platform at the Ford Auditorium with a spotlight on two caskets to my left, speaking in behalf of the Ruther family and the officers and members of the executive board, saying our last farewell to our beloved president, Walter Ruther. All through the eulogies that morning, there was the spirit not of yesterday, but the spirit of tomorrow. And there was good reason for that. Because Walter never looked at yesterday, he always looked at tomorrow. And that's the face that we will be giving our union in the years ahead. I want to join in the special tribute given to Emil tonight for the tremendous and lonesome job which he undertook after Walter's death. You know, in times of severe strain and stress, any large organization needs a very strong and steady hand to hold it together during the period of transition, so that it won't fly apart and it won't tear itself asunder in discord. Emil, in addition to his many other attributes, provided that steady and firm hand, and we thank him for it, all of us. And the fellow sitting next to Emil, Doug Fraser, cemented the teamwork operation of our union. when he, in a very wise and judicious way, stepped down and made the way clear for a unanimous vote on the executive board to make a new and great president of our union, Leonard Woodcock. When I said earlier, before telling that little story, that I understand and comprehend how formidable the tasks are ahead. I've had experience in the General Motors department and at the General Motors bargaining table. As a matter of fact, since 1948, I've been involved in top General Motors negotiations in every single set of negotiations that we've had. But it is not the leadership of our union that makes our union run. And it's not just the membership alone that makes our union what it is. It's the combination of both. We have a strong, a steady, a militant membership, a membership willing to fight when the fight has to be given. And we have a leadership which has experience and commitment and dedication. And we are richly blessed that we have this happy combination of that kind of membership and that kind of leadership. But behind them both, there lies a kind of spark between the elected leadership of our union and the membership of our union that makes our union go. It's the spark of a basic integrity, a basic honesty, one with the other. Our members know that their officers will work their hearts out in behalf of the members and their families, and the officers of this union know that they can always count on the good sense and the goodwill of the members when the going gets tough and the crisis is near. And that is why, if there is any corporation representative anywhere with which we have a contract who believes that he can place obstacles in the way of progress in 1970, he is sadly mistaken. There are no obstacles which we can't overcome, because that's the kind of membership we have, and that's the kind of leadership they have elected to office. We're going to move ahead in 1970, and we're going to move ahead in the years that follow. And together we'll blaze new paths, and we'll seek new glory for our members and for their families and for the communities in which they live. And in that continuing cause, in this new post to which I've been elevated, I want to pledge my heart and hand to you, the members, the local leaders, to the leadership of this union, who have made this opportunity possible. We'll march hand in hand as we always have, under a new leader, a new president, a man who has shown by his experience and his dedication that he will lead us to those new glories that I mentioned. We have many tough decisions ahead, brothers and sisters. You heard Leonard today. You heard him loud and clear. He's a president who has experience. He's a president who is knowledgeable. He's a president who has compassion for the members whom he represents. And as you heard him today, he's also a fighting president. And together, you, the local leaders, the membership you represent, the leadership of this international union whom you've elected to office, together will, in 1970, give them hell.
Thank all of you for being here on a hot, warm night. I want to thank Brother Mazie Fraser, President Woodcock, and Herb Bluestone. They came out as a full team. We've never had that before. And incidentally, some of you have seen President Woodcock leave the rostrum for a few minutes, and he was being interviewed out in the hall by Bob Bennett of Channel 4, so I would suggest if you are home, turn on Channel 4 at 11 o'clock tonight. Okay, the bar is open.
Best speech tonight.
How you doing?
Beauty, what? Trying to speak.
Very good.
Huh? A little bit.
Very good, brother. You were all in tip-top form tonight, you know that.
These things go very well. Four is a lot of three.
Yeah. Did you have a beer before the show?
What did he tell you today?
You like blues better, is it?
Oh, hi, Tony. You know, the nice thing about this all is that these people respond, you know, and they always have. They're ready to go. They're ready to be still. How are you, Ron?
I'm sitting there.
We were talking about beer. That's
yeah, hell, I think we should go and show Dan's office. He's probably got food back there.
Oh, he's also got booze. That's the important thing. Yeah?
Yeah, I've got my briefcases.
One of our hearings won't take place tomorrow.
Scheduled 9:30.
The first stop.
The president called that he wanted it.
He wanted the casting of the phone.
The SD was told me, Guido, he was saying this is what the officer wanted.
I called Cass and I said, you've got to get a hold of Tope and find out. So what we decided to do is not hold it tomorrow. I'm going to have an auditor take a look at the
figure.
December audit. We have December audit casting.
Are all the guys, you haven't told the guys not to be there?
I don't think so.
Hey, how you doing, brother? How are you?
Guys.
Okay. We got some. Yeah, they're clean. That was just water.
I said to Jack the other day, Jack, this is going to be one issue. One issue we're trying to solve, the other guy from the company, spokesman, he says, he didn't endorse him for this. I was there when he endorsed him. So, oh, that means you're going to campaign 2 weeks before the election. I said, well, other people didn't even endorse him until later. And I says, and that other thing, Jack, he broke the heart. He says, we love to endorse him. He was right.
He got trapped in that Chicago.
I don't believe you guys are alcoholics. It's been a hot night.
Thank you. Okay, Ed.
See you guys in the morning.
Okay.
Let me swap with you here on the floor.
Yeah, they are in short down here.
Okay.
During the day. negotiations in 1964, right? Well, he set that pattern that I was talking about. Nice meeting you. What do you know? I just know you got this.